Ah, Chapter 13, Advertising Law, and welcome to it. I always hit Chapter 13 with sort of mixed feelings. And the one case, it means that we're at the end of the semester, because I generally teach it at the very end of the semester. So that's a good thing. But on the other hand, it's some of the more challenging law that we're going to face. This is one area of law where logic doesn't always serve us. Sometimes you'll look at a case and you'll think, well, the case that came before it came out this way, so the case that comes after it should come out this way. And most of the time in the other areas of law, and what I hope I've tried to train you in, is that there's a certain logic to the law. Sometimes you just have to throw that logic out the window. The court has not always been very protective of commercial speech, that is, advertising law, or speech that is paid for by a commercial interest. Okay? So some of these areas of law that we're going to talk about in this chapter are not going to be as straightforward as some of the areas we've talked about before. We'll talk about something called the Central Hudson Test. You'll either love the Central Hudson Test or you hate it. I lean more toward hating than loving, but that's the way the law is. We'll spend some time talking about how that test works. It is still good law today, although perhaps in my lifetime, at the end of my lifetime, or maybe even in your lifetime, it'll be entirely possible that we won't have it anymore. And I'll explain why in a minute. All right, I'm going to start out by explaining the whole notion behind this. Commercial speech doctrine. Commercial speech doctrine is really just a fancy way of saying advertising law. From the very beginning of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this area, commercial speech or advertising got no First Amendment protection. Zero, zip, zilch, nada, nothing. Okay? If speech was bought or paid for with the intention to sell a product, sell a service, sell a good, the Supreme Court pretty much was comfortable saying it doesn't get any protection. That means that government can regulate it any way it wants to. And it did that for many years. Starting in the 1970s and into the 1980s, we started to see a development of this commercial speech doctrine. Today, there is some limited protection to persuasive speech, speech that is intended to sell goods or services, and to some degree also public relations speech intending to sell goodwill. Okay? The court does have a test called the Central Hudson Test that we'll talk about in just a few minutes that regulates how commercial speech is to be regulated. It gives us a four-part test. Okay? The court has waffled over years. That's why there's a waffle there, other than it looks good. The court sometimes goes back and forth on this. Do we give it protection? Do we not give it protection? Case law is sort of erratic. As I said, sometimes you'll take a look at a law or a case and you'll say, well, why shouldn't this come out this way if the case before came out this way? And the answer is, well, the court said so. It's not a very satisfying answer, and I realize that. I don't think it's getting a whole lot better. Since I've been teaching this since about the mid-1990s, commercial speech law keeps getting more and more and more complex. The court still doesn't know whether it's coming or going. We do have, however, a champion on the Supreme Court in this area, and that's Clarence Thomas, the same guy we talked about last chapter, who was interested in getting rid of the dual system of regulation for broadcast media, under the same sorts of ideas, wants to get rid of the dual system that regulates advertising. He has said, why are we keeping truthful information from interested people? Why do we have this silly commercial speech doctrine? If he could get five votes, he would get rid of it in a heartbeat. Now, he doesn't have five votes right now, but the personnel of the court has been changing. A couple old justices out, a couple new justices in. Maybe it's possible in your lifetime, or maybe even in mine, that we'll see the commercial speech doctrine go out the window. Okay? But until that time, some of my answers to your questions are going to be because the court says so. You simply have to know it. Simply have to memorize it. I know that's not satisfying. You don't have to agree. You just got to know. Okay, let's talk about early law. Valentine versus Christensen, 1942. The first time the court decided to look at advertising and see whether or not it wanted to give it protection. The answer was unfortunate for advertisers. Mr. Christensen owned a yellow submarine. Okay, it's not yellow. I made that up, but that's the picture. He owned a submarine. It was a World War I extra sub, surplus sub, and he wanted to recoup his costs for it by selling submarine rides. Now, when one has a submarine, one has to store a submarine. So he wanted to store his submarine in the New York wharfs, the docks, okay? And when he asked for permission to store his submarine at the docks, he was told no. So crafty Mr. Christensen did a smart thing, or so he thought. He had handbills or pamphlets printed out, like little flyers printed out. And on one side, he had an ad saying, you know, pay a nickel and you can get a submarine ride. That's to defray his costs. And on the other side, he had political speech complaining about the rules that the New York wharfs, the docks, had that wouldn't let him store his submarine at the docks. Okay? So he had political protest speech on one side and an advertising on the other. Okay? So when people are handed a handbill, what do you suppose they do? Many of them drop it. If you're lucky, they walk to a trash can and throw it out, but not everybody is quite that neat. So Mr. Christensen's flyers were ending up all over the streets. He was arrested for violating the sanitation law in the city of New York. And he said, well, wait a minute here. My speech is political speech. I'm arguing here that I should have been permitted to store my submarine at the wharf. Yeah, there's advertising on one side, but I'm really complaining here, and that should be highly protected. And the Supreme Court said, you're not fooling anybody. The intention of your handbill was to advertise rides on your sub. The fact that you had political speech on the other side is really just an attempt to pull the wool over our eyes, and we're smarter than that, Mr. Christensen. The First Amendment does not apply to purely commercial advertising. Okay? So it doesn't start out very good for advertising and the First Amendment. Right? Pretty much the Supreme Court says, no protection. Zero protection. Thanks for playing. Go home. Okay? Now we start to see this doctrine chipped away at a little bit over the years. It started out pretty hardcore, no protection. As we're going to see, it starts to soften up a little bit until we get to Central Hudson. All right, so let's turn to a couple of those cases where there starts to be a little bit of a softening. Starting out with the Pittsburgh Press case. Pittsburgh Press versus Pittsburgh Commission on Human Relations. This was about want ads, advertisements looking for people to fill jobs. Okay, and what newspapers used to do back in the 60s and 70s is they used to segregate their ads. They would say jobs male interest, jobs female interest. All right, and the jobs that were in the male interest were doctors and lawyers and firefighters and police officers. And as you might guess, the jobs female interest were nurses and librarians, all right, house cleaners perhaps. You see the gendering, right, the stereotypical gendering there, all right. There was an argument that there was an anti-discrimination law that was violated by this segregation of the jobs, okay. The law was challenged, and the court said the law is okay. These sections are basically illegal advertising. You are essentially writing your advertisements in a way that is discriminatory. You are discouraging women from applying for, quote, male jobs and men from applying for, quote, female jobs. That ran afoul of the law, right? So we start to see that advertising is going to be regulated a little bit more here, okay? And that there should be some issue in thinking about how advertising is going to be regulated. Let's talk about the Bigelow case, a little bit easier of a case, I think. Back in the early 1970s, the United States was a patchwork of state regulations on how abortion was to be regulated. In some states it was legal, some states it was illegal. That changed in 1973 with Roe versus Wade. But before that time, it was legal to have an abortion in New York, but illegal to have an abortion in Virginia. However, people could get in their car and drive from Virginia to New York to get an abortion where it was perfectly legal. So Mr. Bigelow, who owned a New York abortion clinic, started placing ads in Virginia newspapers saying, we know that you can't have an abortion in Virginia. We're hoping that law will change, but until it does change, you know, feel free to jump in your car and come have an abortion in New York where it's completely legal. The state wasn't very happy about this and fined him. All right, he was convicted, and the Supreme Court overturned his conviction and said, look, this ad focuses on a critical area of American politics today, whether or not we should legalize abortion. It contains factual information like the fact that it's illegal in Virginia and legal in New York, how much the abortion costs, talking a little bit about some of the issues. Therefore, it's newsworthy, and as we know, newsworthiness, oh, that's like the Holy Grail, right? And of public interest, and therefore protected speech. So we start to see a little bit of a crack in the whole idea that under Christensen that there was no protection. Okay? So now we're starting to see the development of the commercial speech doctrine. Okay? The best time advertising ever had, the high watermark, is a case called Virginia State Board of Pharmacy versus Virginia Citizens Consumer Council, 1976. Okay, again, the dates aren't important, but that date will become important in just a minute. Virginia seems to be involved in a lot of these cases and advertising law. I don't know why that is. Virginia at the time had a law that said that licensed pharmacists could not advertise prescription drug prices. So even though they may sell, you know, fill in your prescription, let's say codeine after surgery, for X dollars, they couldn't advertise that. The argument was, Virginia said, that you don't really want people knowing how much these drugs cost because it may encourage marketers to market them more aggressively to people who don't need them. But the law that said that those prices couldn't be advertised was challenged, and the Supreme Court overturned the law and said some really wonderful things about advertising. All right, so it completely turned Christensen on its head. It said First Amendment does apply, speech doesn't lose protection simply because money is spent to purchase it and it's selling goods or services. Advertising may be more durable, that means long-lasting, than other speech. And if you regulate it properly, it's unlikely to be chilled. People are still going to want to buy advertisements to advertise their goods and services. And finally, the court said, bottom line out of the Virginia State Board case, if the ads are not deceptive and they are for legal products, they are protected. That's really wonderful. And boy, do I wish it had stopped right there. Now, it didn't, as we're going to see in 4 years in the Central Hudson case. But, interestingly, Justice Rehnquist, who was a justice at the time and was later Chief Justice, said, I really don't agree with this. I really think we ought to have this law because I'm convinced that pharmacists might be advertising not only prices, but really encouraging these drugs to be prescribed and purchased. And as I watch TV and I see all the advertisements for Cialis and Viagra and restless leg syndrome and Latisse for your eyelashes and, you know, the stuff that makes it more comfortable to go, I have to wonder if Rehnquist wasn't right. Rest his soul. He's been dead now for some years, but maybe he was right. Bottom line, though, is this Virginia State Board of Pharmacy case was the best advertising ever had it. And it only lasted for four sweet, wonderful years, until 1980, when we get to the major case, Central Hudson. Okay? The full name of the case is Central Hudson Gas and Electric Corp. versus Public Service Commission. It's a 1980 Supreme Court case. I promise you it will be on your final exam, and I promise you it will be the case study on your final exam, because it has a four-part test. Okay? Four-part test. Now, back in the 1970s, when I was in grade school, I remember that, in fact, if you look at some of the rooms around campus, you can still see little stickers that say, turn the light out when you leave. There was this thing called an energy crisis, all right? And the idea was that people were using fuel, you know, too much, and New York decided to pass a law that prohibited advertising that promoted the use of electricity during this fuel shortage. So in other words, there couldn't be ads taken out saying, you know, isn't light wonderful? The effect of isn't light wonderful, okay? Now, there was an insert that was printed up and put into the electric and power bill. You guys know when you open up a bill for SoCal Gas and Electric or whatever, there's a lot of junk in there. That's not the bill. It's not just the bill in the envelope, but there's sometimes a newsletter, sometimes flyers, sometimes advertisements. And there was an insert in these New York power bills saying, isn't nuclear energy great? Nuclear energy would solve all of our energy issues. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we would just authorize it? Nuclear opposition groups wanted equal space to rebut those claims. And when Central Hudson said, no, we're not going to let you put that additional information in there, that organization sued. Okay? Now, the regulation that prohibited advertising was what was challenged here. All of these cases are about challenging laws that regulate advertising. I'll say that again because it's a little bit confusing. We're not really challenging the advertising, although we'll talk a little bit about the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and how it does that later on. The Central Hudson test is a test on regulation of advertising. That's an important concept. So in this case, the regulation that New York had was overturned. The court expressly limited the amount of First Amendment protection, said yes, it gets First Amendment protection, but the government has the right to regulate if it meets this four-part test. Okay? So there is a four-part test, and again, it will be on your final exam, and it will be your case study for the final exam. Let's walk through it. First, the government or the court will look at the number part one, which is the ad must concern lawful activity and not be misleading. I'll go through all the four pieces first. Second, the state must prove a substantial state interest to be served by the regulation. Third, the regulation must advance the interest. And fourth, the regulation must be no more extensive than necessary to advance the interest. In other words, there needs to be a fit between the regulation and the interest. Okay? Now let's take this apart a little bit. First of all, basically the part one is to stop people from writing ads, publishing ads for illegal goods or services. No matter how cheaply you sell your crystal meth, you can't advertise it because it's not lawful. All right? And you must not write misleading ads. For example, let's say that you open your newspaper Sunday morning and you see that there's an ad that says that your local grocery store is selling a gallon of milk for $1. That's a pretty good deal. So you go running down to your local grocery store and you find out that they are, quote, all sold out of that milk, but here, you can buy the $5 a gallon of milk instead. That's called bait and switch, and it's not okay. You have to have a rain check, or they've got to have some sort of disclaimer on it. Okay, so bottom line for part one, lawful activity and not be misleading. That's usually not a problem for regulations. You're not going to challenge a regulation that says you can't advertise, you know, illegal drugs. Okay? Number two, the state must prove a substantial state interest. All right, that's served by the regulation. Substantial is a pretty small legal word. We've been talking about heavyweight words, in a sense, all the way through. Compelling, that's a big word. It means big things in the law. Overriding, big word, big word. Substantial is just a little tiny word. And it is a walk in the park for the state to prove a substantial state interest. Anything that you can think of that is reasonable for the state to regulate could fall under substantial state interest. Protecting kids, fighting obesity, whether childhood or adult, fighting smoking, fighting drug addiction, making sure the streets are pretty, you know, beautification stuff. All of this stuff can be regulated under this rule. Bottom line is, parts one and two are very easy for the regulation to meet. You very rarely see a regulation fall apart on parts one and two. Parts three and four are a lot more problematic. Part three says the regulation has to advance the interest. Okay? So let's say the state has a substantial, has said that they're regulating a particular kind of advertising to meet a state interest of protecting children. That's a very common one. In order for part three to be met, the state has to make the argument that whatever regulation on advertising it's put into place, it will protect children. So three is connected to two. Okay? Four is also connected to two. Regulation must be no more extensive than necessary to advance the interest. In other words, the government likes small solutions in this area. Any regulation that covers too much speech is going to be frowned upon by the Central Hudson Test. All right? So both parts 3 and 4, which are the hardest for regulations to meet, are tied back into state interest that is announced in number 2. So bottom line, it's pretty easy for the state to meet 1, pretty easy for the state to meet 2, much harder for the state to meet 3 and 4, which are tied to 2. Okay? So once the state has an interest, it's got to make sure that the regulation advances the interest and is no more extensive than necessary. Let me give you an example, and I'll continue to give you examples throughout this recording. Let's say that Cal State Fullerton is a little bit worried about, okay, a lot worried, because it's going to regulate some advertising here, is worried about young women, students on campus getting pregnant, all right? Which, you know, that's a concern. It's a reasonable concern, because if you're pregnant, you're somewhat less likely to be able to finish school, although certainly I've had plenty of pregnant students finish classes and done very well. But some students want to drop out, and of course, then you have other things on your plate other than worrying about studying for anything, comm law or otherwise, okay? So Cal State Fullerton says, and it's a state organization, so Central Hudson is going to apply, Cal State Fullerton says, we're going to ban all advertisements for birth control on campus. The health center can't give away condoms, can't really talk about selling condoms, certainly can't sell them. There can be no ads in the newspaper selling birth control. There can be no billboards. There can be nothing. No advertisements that talk about selling any form of birth control. Okay? State's argument is going to be that if there's fewer opportunities for students to buy birth control, they'll have less sex, and therefore there will be less pregnancy. We can argue about whether or not that's an effective argument, but let's take it for the purposes of this example. So Let's say that the Daily Titan, upset that it can no longer buy advertising from drugstores wanting to sell birth control, challenges the law. Okay? So, state is going to have to prove the ad must concern lawful activity and not be misleading. Well, frankly, we can talk a lot about whether or not it's legal to have sex outside of marriage. But in any event, certainly selling condoms is legal. Selling, you know, birth control pills is legal. Selling all those other different forms of contraception, the Mirena, whatever, that's all legal. Okay? We won't argue about whether or not it's legal to have sex outside of marriage. I actually have to look up my state law for that. I don't know if that's true or not here. Now, so part one's easy. State's got that. The state now has to prove a substantial state interest. Well, it is reasonable that the state, in this case, Cal State Fullerton, would want to reduce the number of pregnancies on campus because a pregnancy makes it less likely that a woman is going to finish her degree, simply because 9 months later you have a bambino. That's how it works, okay? So, and again, substantial state interest is easy to prove. The state doesn't even have to break a sweat. Parts one and two are easy. Now, where it gets harder is parts three and four. The regulation has to advance the interest. The state must provide evidence, and that's up to them, that making birth control advertising less available to students will result in fewer pregnancies. That's going to be a hard pill to swallow. It's going to be tough to do, right? But that's the argument they have to make. They have to argue that the regulation, that is the ban on advertising, advances the state interest, which is fewer pregnancies. Hard to do. And finally, the regulation must be no more extensive than necessary. Well, Cal State Fullerton's hypothetical ban here is on all advertising for all birth control. That's an awfully big ban, isn't it? Right? Which makes it somewhat challenging that Part 4 is going to be met. So if I were on the jury, and one of the things I will never ask you, because these things are such weird things and we would have to hear testimony, the whole thing, I'm not generally going to ask you, unless it's crystal clear, slap you across the face, if Central Hudson is going to be met or not. I am going to ask you about the four-part test and how these parts fit together. Okay? But in this case, if I were sitting on the jury, I'd be like, ah, that's out of here. Because, frankly, I don't think it meets Part 3 and 4. Okay? So that's how Central Hudson works. There are case studies on Blackboard if you want to take additional look on that, and we'll return to it again and again.